Today we have an ethics presentation by David Silverstein. For those of you who attended the summit, you may have gotten to hear him speak there. David, and those of you who practice down in the Hillsborough County area, I'm sure know David. He has worked for CWS for a number of years. He was the senior attorney in Hernando County from 1993 to 1999. And then was the managing attorney for District 13 from 1999 to 2004. He's currently with the Office of the Attorney General and the Children's Legal Services Department in Hillsborough County, and he performs a number of trainings for the department and also caseworkers for the CBCs. He did provide some materials for the call, which Liz distributed yesterday, so you will need those materials if you have not already open them up or printed them out, please do so at this time so that you are able to participate in the call. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to David.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Mary Kate. Real glad to be able to do this training for y'all. I'd like to thank all the guardian ad litem attorneys on the call. Y'all are always there in court when I'm there, and I'd like to just take this opportunity to thank you all for all your hard work, for helping kids and basically for helping me, because many of the guardian ad litem attorneys that I've worked with over the years have been a tremendous help to me, especially in conducting trials. All right, some ground rules. What we're going to do is we have two scenarios that we're going to be talking about, and we're going to be discussing the legal and ethical issues involved in those scenarios. The success of this training is going to be your participation. Although, I love hearing myself talk, and I talk to myself all the time. The purpose of this training is not for us to hear me talk. So, and that was a joke, but y'all are on mute, so I'm not going to hear any of y'all laugh. Anyway, what we're going to do is you have two scenarios, scenario one and scenario two, and we're going to take one at a time. And then I also provided you with excerpts from the Rules of Professional Conduct. So we're going to go through the scenarios, as a group together, we are going to identify the ethical issues involved. Just ground rules, I love you to have you participate. Just remember that if you want to participate, wait till someone is finished talking. It's real important for the recording for people that are listening to it after, and even for people on the call. However, there may be occasions, depending on the time, because we're keeping this to an hour, that I may have to disrupt you, and I apologize ahead of time. All right, we're going to look at the first ethical scenario, and it's number one. And what I will do is that for the benefit of you that may not have the materials, or for those of you that are looking at the materials the first time, at the top of the scenario is our different players, different roles, and then we'll get into the scenario, and I'll just read that, and if you'll just read along with me, not out loud, we don't have to do that all out loud. On May 25th, 2007, Partman received the child abuse report, which alleged that Sarah King, age 10, was sexually abused by her stepfather, Joe Barton Sr. Sarah told the investigator that Joe, her stepfather, rubbed her private part with his private part. Sarah stated that she had two siblings, Bonnie Barton, age 7, and Joe Jr., age 6. She said that her siblings were the children of Joe Sr. Sarah said that she told her mother about what Joe did and that her mother did not believe her. Elaine, that's the investigator, responded to the home and spoke with the mother, Patricia Barton, Joe Jr., and Bonnie. Patricia said that she did not believe that Joe abused Sarah. She said that Sarah did not like her stepfather and wanted to live with her father, Bill King, in Ohio. Bonnie and Joe Jr. denied ever being touched inappropriately or seeing anyone being touched inappropriately. Elaine removed Sarah from the home, but left Joe Jr. and Bonnie basically in the home because Carol, who's the DCF attorney, told her there was no legal sufficiency to remove them. At the shelter hearing, Sue Watson, a guardian ad litem, was appointed to represent Sarah's best interests in the case. Bill Jones, guardian ad litem attorney, was assigned to the case. A dependency petition was filed only as to the child, Sarah. The mother consented to the petition. Sarah's father, Bill King, was named in the dependency petition, but there were no allegations in the petition regarding him. Although she had his address, Carol did not have Mr. King served with the petition by mail or through a process server. Elaine appeared at the arraignment hearing and told Carol that Patricia was going to consent to the petition. Elaine said she told Patricia that the only way to get Sarah back would be to consent to the petition and work on a case plan. Sue was present when Elaine told Patricia this, but said nothing at the time. However, she told Phil, the guardian attorney, about the conversation. Patricia waived her right to an attorney, consented to the petition. Both Carol and Phil stood silent as the judge accepted the plea. At the disposition hearing, the court accepted the case plan, which required Patricia to complete a parenting course, non-offender sexual abuse treatment course, and a requirement not to allow Joe Sr. to have contact with Sarah unless he completed sexual offender treatment. Patricia completed her case plan courses and told the case manager, Rob Troop, that Joe Sr. was no longer living in the house. The court granted Patricia unsupervised visitation with Sarah so long as she did not allow contact between Joe Sr. and Sarah. Joe Sr. never completed sexual offender treatment. Rob noticed that Joe Sr.'s car was in the driveway of the family home when Rob made an unannounced visit. And Patricia said that Joe Sr. comes to dinner sometimes when Sarah's not around. Patricia said that she still did not believe that Joe Sr. abused Sarah, but that she would keep him away from Sarah. Rob reported his concerns to Sue. A year passed, and three different case managers handled the case. Trina Slater, the current case manager, asked the DCF attorney to file a motion to reunify Sarah with her mother and siblings because Patricia completed her case plan. When Phil received a copy of the motion, he met with Sue to discuss the case. Sue told Phil that she thought Patricia was doing a great job raising her children. Sue said that she really did not believe Sarah about Joe Sr.'s abuse, and she thought Joe Sr. was a great father to his children. Sue said she didn't have any problems with the motion to reunify, and she thought it would be fine to close the case immediately. Phil asked Sue the date she last saw the children. She said she saw them 4 months before and had not seen them because she was sick and had car problems. Phil determined that all of Sue's visits were announced. Phil was very concerned about Sue's handling of the case. The hearing on the motion to reunify was heard a couple weeks after Phil received the motion. Sue had one announced visit between the receipt of the motion and the hearing. Bill King, Sarah's father, appeared for the motion hearing. Before the hearing, Bill spoke with Phil and said he wants custody of Sarah. Phil said that he thought that it would be a good idea for Bill to obtain custody of Sarah and that he would recommend to the court that Bill get custody of Sarah. Bill thanked Phil. Phil asked Trina whether there was background screen done on Bill King. Trina said that Bill mentioned he had some minor criminal charges, but nothing more. At the hearing, Bill asked for custody of Sarah. Patricia objected. Carol took testimony from Trina, and she said she thought it was the best thing for Sarah. Phil whispered to Sue not to say anything and just let Bill take Sarah. Judge asked Trina if there was anything that would place Sarah at risk with her father. Trina said there was nothing, although Carol and Phil knew that there was no background screen conducted on Bill King, no approved home study from the Ohio Social Service Agency, which you all know is a violation of the Interstate Compact. Carol told the court that the state recommended that the judge place Sarah with Bill King. The judge asked if the guardian ad litem concurred. Phil shook his head affirmatively, and the judge placed Sarah with Bill King and terminated jurisdiction. All right. So, I'm going to help guide you in this discussion, but like I said starting out, I'm going to need your help because we're going to need to identify these ethical issues. In the fourth paragraph of the scenario, it mentions that the DCF attorney never had Mr. King serve with the dependency petition. Are there any ethical obligations towards the guardian ad litem attorney, Phil, regarding that issue? Well, I need some help here.
You could start by looking at 4-3.1 and see whether you're prohibited from proceeding based on it might not be a meritorious claim because of lack of proper service.
Very good. Anything else? Okay. How about the first one that you got on your excerpts? How about 4-1.1? About competence. And actually, throughout this scenario in particular, I was thinking about this a lot. And it's actually, just to give you a heads up, in the next scenario. You know, what is the role of the guardian ad litem and the guardian ad litem attorney in these proceedings when the petitioner is the department? Is there an issue regarding competence? That if the guardian ad litem attorney knows that someone wasn't served, is it their legal obligation, you know, to ensure that there's permanency for the child? Because, you know, if there's a legal issue with service and no personal jurisdiction, that may impact on the permanency for the child, correct? So it may be an issue of competence regarding the guardian ad litem attorney, because he'd never picked up on it and never mentioned anything. Do you all agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I'm sure Tom Young, the appellate lawyer, would definitely agree with that.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. All right. And the next paragraph, you know, where the guardian ad litem hears that there's some shenanigans going on with the investigator telling Patricia, just consent. If you don't, you'll never get your kid back. The guardian ad litem has knowledge of this, and she tells Phil, the guardian ad litem attorney. So what is Phil's ethical duty when he hears that? Anybody?
I think Phil has a mixed ethical obligation because it could be a problem if he brings it up with his case, but on the other hand, it goes back to the same thing you were talking about with the last scenario as far as making sure that your order is not going to be overturned on appeal. So I think he has a mixed obligation there that he needs to balance and make a determination as to what to do.
What if... there really wasn't a problem with the legal effect of the order. Did Phil have a duty just to point out that maybe things weren't done on the up and up? Well, Phil didn't do anything wrong, did he? I mean, he... Or did he? Well, are y'all perplexed or considering the issue? Well, the way I look at it, it may be one of those answers where it depends, because Phil may have a duty. I mean, you mentioned a good point as far as having an ineffectual order or an order that may be challenged on appeal. But the colloquy that the judge asked Patricia as far as determining whether the consent was freely, voluntarily, and intelligently entered into. You know, when the judge goes through the colloquy, what's the judge say? The judge says, has anyone forced you or promised you anything to get you to consent? And if that was the colloquy in this case, after the mother consented, then I would say that Phil would have to have an obligation to let the court know that Patricia may have been forced or may have been promised things to enter the consent. You know, the ethical duty, remember, is just not to the client, but it's also to the process and to the court. We're all, as attorneys, officers of the court.
Excuse me, this is Lori Marks. I'm with the Attorney General's office. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't agree with your assessment at all. I don't think that that particular statement was coercive. I think if a PI says to a parent, well, you ought to consent because that's the only way you're going to get your kids back, that's not coercive.
I don't know, but is that statement, you don't believe that's coercive? Let's hear what someone else thinks.
I think it's coercive. I think that you have an individual who, you know, you have to assume, I don't know what experience she may have had before, is not familiar with the process and may not understand that saying it's the only way you can get your kid back coming from a person who appears to be in a position of authority, that she would understand that that's just their opinion and that there might be other things that you could do legally, such as a case plan, et cetera, to get your child back.
So, but if you're in this gray area where you don't know whether the person's really being forced or not, is there a duty?
I think that's the attorney for the parent's duty.
Okay. So you think that it's the Patricia's attorney's duty to say, why do you want to consent?
Yeah. And believe me, I've been in many a hearing where the parent pipes up and says, well, the PI told me that was the fastest way to get my kid back or the best way to get my kid back. I don't think I've ever heard a parent say it's the only way, but the point is, whatever the PI says to the parent is not what they're supposed to rely on. They're supposed to be talking to their lawyers.
Okay.
And when the judge asks them that in the courtroom, that's when it's supposed to come out or not come out in the colloquy. And if the parent doesn't pipe up and says they're fine with it and they don't feel forced or coerced, they're the only one that knows if they felt forced or coerced.
Well,
in
that's
scenario,
true.
The mom waived counsel, and there's an opportunity for the guardian program attorney to step in at that point and suggest that counsel be appointed.
You know what? I missed that fact. If she did not have counsel present, then I would agree with you that perhaps the guardian might make a recommendation to the court that based on something they had heard, that it might be best for the parent to consult counsel. I would agree with that.
Right.
I missed that part of the scenario. I apologize.
Well, I mean, it's really not... I think that's some good points that y'all are making. You know, there is this issue where under 4-3.3 that there needs to be candor towards the tribunal. You have to disclose material facts to the court to avoid fraud by a client. Phil's client is not committing any fraud. It's just kind of standing there and being silent about the issue. So good discussion. I don't think that there's any easy answer to it, but let me just caution all of you that if you see something that's going on that's not fair, you should consider doing something about it. I'm not saying particularly what you should do, but sometimes we see that in these proceedings where there's things going on that may not be fair. But good point as far as guardian ad litem speaking out and saying that mom may need to speak to an attorney before the court accepts the consent. Okay. Then, moving on with the scenario. We have Patricia, she does her case plan, or jumps through the hoop, so to speak, but she really doesn't believe that Sarah was abused by her husband. And there's some indication that he may not be out of the home, that he may still be in the home and exposed to Sarah in the future. And then you have a number of case managers that are on the case, and the history and the facts sometimes get lost over time. And then there's this motion file to reunify. And then Phil gets with Sue and figures out that Sue may not be doing the best job as guardian ad litem for Sarah. Sue didn't even believe Sarah, that she was abused, thought that Joe's doing a great job as being a father, agrees with the motion. But Sue really hasn't been out to the home to check to see if Joe's basically moved back in the home or not. When there was indication from the case manager to Sue that something may be going on. And all Sue's visits were announced, not unannounced, and Phil's concerned. What are Phil's ethical obligations, if any, regarding the guardian's handling of the case?
I think possibly Phil should start with 4-2.1 and act as an advisor to the client and maybe discuss with her having an unannounced visit or some of his other concerns.
Okay, good. That maybe he should talk to Sue about his concerns as an advisor. What else?
If he talks to her and he doesn't think he's gotten anywhere, he might invoke some of the provisions of 4-1.13 and maybe speak to her supervisor about his concerns or whatever chain you have set up for your organization.
Right. Good point. 4-1.13. When you represent an organization as a client, and correct me if I'm wrong because I'm no expert in this, but your client is the program, correct, and not the individual guardian ad litem. So the organization operates, as it talks about in the rule, through the different executives and staff of the organization. So definitely bringing the concerns to Sue. What if Sue doesn't respond very well? Then what do you do?
Sue's the GAO?
Yes.
Talk to Sue's supervisor?
Right. I mean, just take it up the chain of command. Every organization has a chain of command, and you know, people don't always agree on things, and it's not really getting any someone in any trouble. But if you definitely have concerns, especially in this situation where you have child safety at issue, you just kick it up the chain of command. What my philosophy is that the most eyes on a case, the better. Okay, then we have the issues at the hearing. Bill speaks with Phil and says, hey, I want Sarah. And Phil's like, oh, well, good, because that's where I think that she should be, and I'll recommend that for you. What are the problems with that? What are the ethical issues? Annie?
Bill have a lawyer here?
Bill has no attorney.
And is an adverse, is a party, is an unrepresented party to the case.
Right. So what rule is that?
4-4.3.
And what does that rule specify? Okay. Essentially, what the point in 4-4.3 is communications with third parties. What the attorney's obligation is that when an attorney is talking to a third party, they need to make sure that they make it clear that they're not representing that third party. And here, Phil did not do that. He basically said, good deal, I'm kind of representing you. And Bill probably had a good faith impression that Phil was representing him. Also, just as a note, because some attorneys, they like talking to parents, I always say don't do it, because then, you know what happens if a parent admits something to you, like some abuse or neglect? You've just become a witness in the case, and then you can't handle the case anymore under your ethical rules. Also, one thing that Phil needed to do was Sue is giving him direction. And remember 4-1.2, as far as the objectives and scope of the representation. Remember what that says? What basically that says is that the attorney has to help the client achieve the goal, mm-hmm. and confer with the client in doing that. So Phil had an ethical obligation, if he was not going to do what Sue wanted, to talk to her, at least to talk to her about it, and then maybe take it up the chain of command. Again, if you think about it, I put that that Phil received the motion a couple weeks before the hearing on purpose, because Phil should have been having a discussion if he felt differently than Sue as to what should be the goal in the case, or at least to get some direction, you know, to take it up the chain of command. Do you all agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Then we have the issue with Bill having some criminal history, and then Phil just standing there and letting the case manager tell the judge, hey, you know, I don't know anything that'll put this kid at risk. And then also Phil just standing there, not mentioning anything about the violation of the ICPC. So what ethical rules are in play here?
Candor, truthfulness.
Right, candor to the tribunal. Good. And that it's 4-3.3, because there's Phil is allowing a misrepresentation of material fact to be provided to the court. You know, you could say, oh well, the case manager was just giving her opinion and not giving a fact. And any other Any other rules? There's also, as far as candor with the tribunal, is to let the judge know what the law is as an officer at a court.
He certainly isn't competently representing his client by nodding affirmatively when asked.
Right.
If he was in concurrence without having adequately checked out the situation that the child was going to.
Very good. There's also a competence issue. And then one thing that's not going on ever since Phil started having a problem is the communication issue. You know, 4-1.4. All right. Any other points anyone wants to make on this scenario? And then we'll go to the next. All right. Well, y'all did a great job. Excellent. Let's look at the next scenario, scenario number two. And I'll read that through to you. On March 23rd, 2004, Sally Henson, age 3, and Martin Lowery, age 2, were removed from their mother, Rita Smith, due to medical neglect. Martin had a respiratory infection and mother failed to seek treatment. Martin ended up in the hospital with pneumonia. At that time, Martin's father, Mike Lowery, was residing out of state in South Dakota, exact whereabouts unknown. Location of Ronald Henson, Sally's father, was also unknown. Judge Rogers sheltered the children and appointed Lori Hill as guardian ad litem. Audrey Johnson, guardian ad litem attorney, was assigned to the case. Shortly after the shelter, the mother, Rita, disappeared. Therefore, DCF needed to conduct a diligent search for all the parents. DCF was unable to locate Rita or Ronald. However, they located Mike and served him for an arraignment hearing. DCF alleged medical neglect by the mother and abandonment by his fathers in the dependency petition. At the arraignment, Mike appeared and was appointed an attorney, Luke Waters. Luke told Mike to consent to the dependency petition, and Mike advised the judge that he would move to Florida so he could get custody of his child. Judge Rogers set the matter for a disposition hearing. Before the disposition hearing, Lori met with Mike to discuss the case. Lori said she was concerned that Mike had two arrests 4 years before for cocaine possession. Mike said that it was in the past and none of her business. Lori was very upset this conversation and really began to dislike Mike. Lori told Audrey that she was very concerned for Martin's safety with Mike. Audrey responded, "Just tell me what you want. You know Judge Rogers will agree whatever we want. His mother was a former guardian ad litem." At the disposition hearing, DCF presented a case plan to the judge, which had tasks for Mike to complete: a parenting course, maintain stable housing, maintain sufficient income to meet the child's needs, and visit the child. Audrey requested that the case plan include a substance abuse evaluation, random drug screens, and a psychological evaluation. Audrey said that it was criminal for DCF to have presented such an inadequate case plan to the court. Luke objected, stating there was no proof that he has abused any, well, that Mike has abused any drugs, and that his last drug charge was 4 years before. Luke said that there was no basis for the mental health evaluation. Audrey responded that the guardian was concerned about the criminal charges and Mike would not discuss the issue with Lori. Judge Rogers, of course, accepted the case plan with the additional task by the guardian ad litem. 6 months passed. DCS diligent search never located Rita or Ronald. Mike maintained a stable and suitable home, worked a steady job, made sufficient income. The substance abuse evaluation concluded that Mike did not need any treatment. All 10 drug screens which Mike took were clean. The mental health evaluation did not indicate any need for treatment. Mike visited with Martin, but missed two visits due to a conflict with his work schedule. He completed a parenting course, except he never received a certificate because he failed to pay for some of the classes. DCF files a TPR petition. DCF submitted an affidavit, a diligent search for Rita and Ronald. The affidavit did not indicate whether DCF contacted armed forces or child support enforcement for Rita and Ronald. Court conducted an advisory hearing, entered a consent to the termination of parental rights petition regarding Ronald and Rita. Judge Rogers set the TPR trial for Mike. After the advisory hearing, the new CBC case manager was assigned to the case. He thought Mike was doing a great job, told the DCF attorney to dismiss the petition regarding the child Martin. Lori heard about this and quickly asked Audrey to file a TPR petition. Audrey requested Lori to ask Mike for his current pay stubs and a copy of his work schedule on the dates that he missed visits. At the trial, it was revealed that Mike had completed his case plan. The case manager paid for Mike's parenting classes, and Mike had a certificate of completion. Audrey objected to the introduction of the certificate because it was hearsay. The judge sustained the objection. Audrey took testimony from Lori that the children were bonded to each other and to the foster parents. Lori admitted that Martin got along well with Mike. Mike testified that he would take both siblings to keep them together. Audrey argued in her closing argument that Mike had failed to substantially comply with the case plan by failing to make all the visits with Martin and his failure to provide a completion certificate for the parenting course. Luke argued that Mike had completed his case plan and had a good relationship with his child. Judge Rogers indicated that he was taking the case under advisement. After the trial, Audrey stayed to talk to Judge Rogers. The judge said, "You know, you have a weak case on this guy." Audrey responded, "He technically failed to comply with his case plan, and the GAL is very concerned about the child's safety." Judge Rogers entered an order terminating parental rights of all the parents. Okay. Starting with the disposition hearing. And just before, there was a conversation between Lori and Audrey saying, and Audrey says, "You know, Judge Rogers, he'll agree to whatever we want because his mom was a former guardian ad litem." Are there any ethical issues regarding that conversation?
(clears throat) 4-3.1, meritorious claims.
Okay. So how does that impact on the conversation?
A lawyer has a duty to only bring a meritorious claim or defense. So if she's being asked to do something that doesn't have a sufficient legal or factual basis, just because she thinks the judge will do anything they want, then she's not presenting a meritorious claim.
Right. What else? Was it okay for Audrey to say, "Just tell me what you want, you know, Judge Rogers is going to go along with us"? Is that okay to give advice like that?
I had marked down 4-1.2 as well, that she should speak to her regarding the objectives of the representation. And you might also throw in 4-2.1, the lawyer as advisor.
Excellent. That's right. As an advisor, even though you look at that and you say, "Hey, that's really not on the up and up," the thing is that as an advisor, an attorney can base legal advice on things that are not legal. So, you know, is that good advice? You know, just say, "Hey, tell me what you want, we'll get it." Is that good? No, but as far as ethics, the attorney could base advice on what the judge is going to do. All right, and then at the disposition hearing, you mentioned that there's the issue with meritorious claims. Does anyone think that there was any legal basis for substance abuse evaluation, random drug screens, and the psych eval?
Well, he had a criminal history for substance abuse.
Okay, so, and how long ago was that?
I think in the scenario it was 4 years earlier.
Right, so is that sufficient?
And it was two arrests. So I think there was enough I think the scenario gave enough background on the father to ask for a substance abuse evaluation and a drug screen.
Okay. Does everyone agree with that? Well, looks like you may have people that agree with you. The reason why I put 4 years in was because I thought that maybe there wouldn't be, because so much time had passed and there was no proof of a current problem.
I think it may depend on your judge also as to, I think most guardian ad litems would probably, given that it was an out-of-state father that no one is familiar with, they'd probably err on the side of caution regarding asking for a substance abuse evaluation and some random screens. Psychological, I'm not so sure about.
Right. Right. Is there any basis that there may be a mental health issue?
Nothing that was really given in the scenario to warrant it.
Okay.
That I saw.
So the issue, as far as the disposition and the case plan, is 4-3.1, the meritorious claims. You have to have a good faith argument under the law that there's sufficiency. And you just can't, you know, go in and tack on tasks without having a legal basis for it. Then, how about the problem with there was the TPR petition filed, and then the judge entered a consent regarding the two missing parents when there's an indication that maybe the diligent search wasn't very diligent? What's the issue there? Well, what about, again, 4-3.3, the candor towards the tribunal, that there may be a misrepresentation to the court that there was a diligent search? And let me just throw this out just so that we're all clear. You know, the guardian ad litem did not file the TPR petition yet. DCF did. Does the guardian ad litem attorney have an ethical obligation to the court, or is it the DCF's attorney's problem? Should the guardian ad litem tell the DCF attorney, hey, you know, you need to bring this to the court's attention, or does the guardian ad litem have an obligation?
Guardian ad litem would have an obligation to the court, and you also have the argument you raised in regards to the earlier scenario, that they have an obligation to make sure that they are fulfilling their client's objectives. And
right. And see, the objective is always to get the child to permanency, right? So if there is something in the process that is hindering that, for example, the lack of a diligent search, then there's the ethical obligation arises. And then you have the issue with 4-3.1, the meritorious claims, because it's not just a petition you're filing, it's any argument that you make or any fact that you propose to the court. It has to have merit. And here you have this diligent search, and it looks like it's incomplete. On the other hand, someone can argue, well, you could in good faith argue that they did everything else in the search, and just because they didn't do these two little things, big deal. Okay. Then the TPR petition gets dismissed, and the guardian ad litem picks up the TPR petition. So, are there any ethical obligations regarding that?
Oh, yeah. That TPR petition, as far as the Father Mike is concerned, should never have been filed.
Okay.
I mean, they were going after this guy because the guardian didn't like him and wasn't concerned about him. I mean, was concerned, allegedly, for the children's safety. But realistically, those concerns weren't based on either any factual or legal basis. And for her to just, you know, have the lawyer file the petition as to that dad, I understand as to the mom and the stepdad, but certainly not as to Mike.
Because, right. Now,
it's a technical violation. What he did was just a matter of getting the paperwork.
Right. Again, this is 4-3.1, the meritorious claims.
Yeah.
Now, could the guardian ad litem attorney have a good faith basis at this point in the case to argue that the TPR petition is filed in good faith?
I think you can make the argument that it was.
Okay. How about the fact that Audrey requested Lori to ask Mike for his current pay stubs and copy of his work schedule? The guardian attorney kind of having the guardian ad litem do some discovery. Are there any ethical issues regarding that? Do you all think...
He went through his attorney.
Right, this guy is represented by an attorney.
But was this after the guardian had picked up the TPR or before the guardian picked up the TPR?
After.
This is after.
And I don't think there's any issue with it because that if they're picking up the TPR, they need evidence. I mean, I think there's an issue with the fact that they filed the TPR petition at all, but once they had to that, they still need to have to get evidence to prove that the father should be TPR'd.
Can I clarify?
But they should have done a request for discovery.
Excuse me, is the question that, sorry, that they asked for the information at all or that they asked Mike as opposed to his attorney?
That the guardian ad litem attorney asked the guardian to ask Mike.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's clearly
a
violation.
Yeah, that's that.
Okay. And what's that?
That's dealing with
represented counsel. You have to understand. I mean, your guardian program is the party, not the guardian. So if the program is the party, then the program has to follow the rules of discovery, and they can't contact the other party when that person is represented and ask for discovery. It's a violation of the discovery rule, and it's a violation of the ethics rules that say that you cannot communicate with a represented party.
Actually, it's the attorney who can't contact the unrepresented party, and I think that this is a much subtler question of whether the attorney can instruct a client, because clients can talk all they want if they choose to do so. It's really not the attorney contacting the unrepresented party. It's a question of whether an attorney can suggest his client contact another client.
But what about you're asking that your client act on your behalf? She's asking for discovery on for the legal proceedings.
But what
she's
about
not
the,
gutting them just to further her own concerns.
The guardian has a duty to investigate the cause, you know, the claims that are being made in the petition. That's right there in the statute. If they can't do that, then what are we saying?
Well, the question is, why wasn't that done prior to the guardian litem having to pick up the TPR petition? Their investigation should have been done during dependency. There was no need to have it done during what should have been the discovery process in the TPR.
Yeah, but maybe he just got this job.
Okay, well, let's say that. I mean, you're right that the guardian has to go and talk to the parent, but the guardian isn't supposed to be seeking evidence that's going to be used at trial. They're not supposed to be asking for documentation to prove their case. It's one thing for the guardian to be asking, hey, do you have pay stubs? And you might want to give those to your lawyer, because the guardian's walking a line. The guardian's supposed to represent the best interests of the child. And honestly, if that parent has pay stubs, then it's the guardian's obligation to notify the court that the parent is lawfully employed and that the parent has done whatever he's done. But it sounds like this guardian's looking to sabotage this dad, and the attorney is allowing the guardian to go far beyond the scope of the guardian's responsibility.
Right. All right. Well, I think that y'all picked up on it. There's, you really have to watch out, because you know that you shouldn't be talking to anybody who is represented by counsel without their counsel's consent. And really what the guardian ad litem attorney is doing is they are trying to do that. They're trying to communicate. Audrey is trying to communicate with Mike through Lori.
Well, all of our guardians get permission from the lawyers to talk to the parents. So if that's the case, then does that solve the problem?
Sure. That would. Okay. And then the other problem is, I put this in the scenario, is that there's an issue of competence here. The guardian ad litem picked up the petition that was dismissed. Remember, the judge entered a consent based on the diligent search and just assumed that there was proper publication of the mom, but the petition was dismissed. So does there need to be another publication? Does there need to be another service done of the mom or attempted service?
Well, the guardian program filed a new petition, right?
That's right. They filed a new petition.
Well, then they need to basically start from scratch with new publication and new service attempts.
Right. And that's, again, 4-1.1, the lack of service would be a competence issue. Because here, the guardian ad litem's trying to help the child by filing the TPR petition, yet sabotaging it because then the mother can come in and challenge it because she never got served with the petition. Okay. Does anyone have any ethical issues with Audrey objecting to the introduction of the parenting certificate because it was hearsay? Does anyone?
I thought about that, but I think you're just making an objection here.
Right.
The court to rule on, and it is an out-of-court document. There may be exceptions, but I don't know that you can say she's necessarily violating an ethical rule by making a hearsay objection.
Okay. Does anyone think otherwise? That there may be an issue does Audrey, does she really have a good faith belief that that certificate is not authentic?
Actually, I don't think it matters if she has a good faith belief. I think the bigger question is she diligently and zealously representing her client? And at that point, she's probably grasping at some straws. And as long as you can make the objection, and it's not a completely invalid objection because the document, as the other attorney said, is definitely hearsay, then, you know, it's up to the judge to decide whether or not the judge wants to see the original certificate or hear some testimony to authenticate the copy. But you have an obligation to diligently and zealously represent your client. So the objection itself, actually, if she sat on her hands and didn't object, because as one of my colleagues mentioned, she might get overruled, that's not a good thing to do either. You have to be diligent and zealous. You can't just sit back.
Okay, good. I mean, I just threw that issue out there, you know, whether it was meritorious to do a hearsay objection when you know that evidence that's being entered, that there's really no question as to whether it's valid or not. Okay, then as far as the closing argument, that even though Mike, he really did complete the parenting class, poor guy, and he only missed a couple visits because of his work, Audrey argues on closing that he failed to substantially comply with his case plans. Is there an ethical issue regarding that? Or at that time in the trial, because the judge didn't let the certificate in, is that a meritorious claim? Is that a meritorious argument? What do you all think?
I think it's a fine line, but that she's skating. And but I think that wording it as failed to provide the certificate is accurate. I mean, she kept it out, but in the long run, he did fail to provide it. And like I said, I think she's really walking the edge of the envelope here, or pushing the edge of the envelope with it.
Okay. And the missing two visits, is that, can someone in good faith say that just missing a couple visits, that's grounds for failing to substantially comply?
I don't think that's, I think that's one of those subjective issues. I mean, would I do it? No, I think I think it makes you look bad as a lawyer in front of the judge, quite frankly, but I don't think it's an ethical violation. You're making a diligent argument on behalf of your client that these items put together are a totality of the circumstance. I mean, you know, I think this lawyer needs to get fired, but then again, the lawyer's trying to do what the guardian wants and is letting the guardian drive the bus, and that's where the original problem comes from in the first place. So once you've compounded the error by going forward, now she's between a rock and a hard place because she's got to pursue her case, or she's tanking it, which is a violation.
Right. What?
You know, either way, she's damned if she does and she's damned if she doesn't.
Right. What's the definition in the statute for substantial compliance? Isn't it that someone basically takes care of the situation that caused the department from being involved and that the child would be safe in the home?
It actually is that the all the reasons why the case came into care have been remedied to the extent that the child's health, safety, and welfare can be assured in the custody of, and then fill in the blank. If you believe the child can go home to the parent because the reasons have been remedied, that doesn't mean they have to have completed every single task, but it must mean that the reasons why the case came into care have been sufficiently remedied.
Right.
There again, it's subjective.
Well, but it's subjective, but is doing all the classes and not having a certificate, is that not substantially complying? Is attending all the visits except for a couple, is that not substantially complying?
Well, you've got to ask the question of the witness, did you verify that the parent completed the classes? And if the witness says yes, then whether or not they have a certificate, quite frankly, is irrelevant because there's nothing in the statute that says you have to provide a certificate. It just says you have to successfully complete.
Right. So that's what my point here is about Audrey's closing, arguing the lack of substantial compliance. Then we have the issue where after the trial, Audrey stays back and has a little conversation with Judge Rogers. And they talk about the case. What is the ethical problem with that?
4-3.5.
Right, and that's the impartiality and decorum of the tribunal. Because they're talking about the substance of the case. Even though you would say that it really didn't add anything. There was no outright... nothing outright that Audrey was trying to really influence the judge because it was the same thing she said in her closing. But the thing is that if you talk to the judge about the substance of the case, that's going to be an ex parte communication with the judge. Any other issues that anyone picked out? Ethical issues that you picked out in the second scenario? Okay. Well, there's some trends that I wanted to point out in the scenarios in the discussion. One major one is y'all's role in the proceedings as far as getting the case to permanency, and that if DCF, for whatever reason, isn't getting there, you know, that there's a lack of service, there's a lack of diligent search, that there's some problem with the case, that the guardian ad litem has an obligation, an ethical duty to speak up to try and correct those problems with the case. And then another, just in general, if an attorney has a problem with a case, they need to take it up the chain of command, and it needs to go as far as possible until the issue is resolved. you know, we as attorneys, we get a lot of issues that hit us when we're in the middle of court. And sometimes you have to punt and you have to say, Judge, could we have a continuance? Because I need to discuss this issue. So those are two running themes, the constant communication issue and then y'all's role in getting the child to permanency. Well, let me just say, you all did a fantastic job. I mean, all the rules that I had written out that pertain to these scenarios, y'all got, and very quickly. And, you know, it almost seemed like I had planted some helpers with my training because y'all did so well. So does anyone have any questions or comments? If not, y'all did a fantastic job. I really appreciate y'all having me conduct this training today. I hope that you learned something. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. Thank you.
Thanks so much, David.